Welcome to the Office Space Podcast, where we discuss relevant topics that are affecting occupiers of office space. I'm your host, Dougal Jeppy with Colliers International. And today our guests are Brian Spangler with the law firm Katten-Muchin Rosenman and Stacey Osmond with the law firm DLA Piper. Brian and Stacey are accomplished Chicago-based real estate attorneys with office leasing experience on both the landlord and the tenant side. So for today's discussion, Stacey's going to focus on the tenant's perspective while Brian's going to take on the landlord's perspective. I'm hoping this format will effectively show both positions on relevant office lease topics. So Brian and Stacey, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Stacey, let's start with you. Tell us something about your firm and your background.
Sure. So like you said, I'm Stacey Osmond. I'm an attorney at DLA Piper, and we're a large international law firm. My practice is a broad practice. It focuses on commercial real estate and really includes all sorts of transactions that touch real estate. So that includes, you know, acquisitions, dispositions, leasing, financing, real estate investment, joint ventures and development. My clients span across industry sectors, and they range from small startups to investment firms to international corporations. And I'm originally from St. Louis, so if you get a little twang, that's where it comes from. But I've been living in the Chicago area since 2017.
Can you really call yourself like Southern if you're from St. Louis?
When your mom's from Tulsa, yes.
Okay, we'll go with it, yeah. Thanks. Brian, what about yourself?
Yeah, first and foremost, Dougal, thanks for inviting me to the podcast. Really excited about this one. My name is Brian Spangler. I'm an attorney in a real estate practice at Katten. We are also a full-service law firm with offices both in the U.S. and overseas. I practice out of our Chicago office and like Stacey, represent everybody from startups to private equity companies, REITs, developers, financial institutions, high net worth individuals and other institutional type investors, really across a broad array of real estate, debt and equity based transactions. So to name a few, purchases and sales, joint ventures, preferred equity investments, ground up development, and of course, financing transactions. And then my practice also includes a fairly substantial amount of leasing work, everything from ground leases, sale net leaseback deals, and more traditional office and space leasing.
And have you guys ever been on opposite sides of the table from each other on anything?
Fortunately for me, no.
yeah, I was gonna say, I don't think so. I've been opposite Katten before, but we haven't crossed yet.
Okay. Well, good. Well, this is a positive discussion, and so there won't be any too much back and forth on this. But the first question, we'll start with you, Stacey. What are some of your clients concerned about right now?
Yeah, so if I'm thinking about my tenant clients, you know, they have the obvious concern. How are we keeping the business going for a lot of them? Which leads to questions about rent deferrals, rent forgiveness, can I abate rent? And looking into those questions, as well as, you know, what are other options do we have if we don't need the space anymore? Is there a sublease available that we could get out, you know, get someone else on the hook here? Or is it possible to negotiate a termination with the landlord? So kind of that whole range of questions, I think, is still ongoing, especially as the, you know, this issue and the pandemic goes on longer, I think, than people really originally expected. I think these issues are just continuing to bubble up. And then there's, you know, the ones related to going back to work. How do we ensure the safety of our employees when we go back? So that goes from what steps do we need to take within our space to provide a safe working environment? And as you guys know, there's tons of consultants and guides and all sorts of things and resources out there on those topics. But, you know, a lot of my tenant clients are still thinking about that, as well as looking at what is the landlord doing to provide a safe common area for accessing the premises? What are they doing? What should they be doing? And are those aligned?
And have you found that, you know, have you seen any trend in terms of, like initially there was a lot of rent deferment questions on my end I was getting from clients. Are you still seeing that at the same pace kind of initially, or what are you seeing on that end?
I would say the discussion is still evolving. I think when we first had this happen, everybody, you know, had the stay at home orders. I think the first question was, do I have to pay rent? Can I look at the lease and get out of rent? And I'm having that conversation a little less. I think most of us have talked that concept to death. And now it's more of how do we approach the landlord? How can we negotiate something to kind of get some relief here?
Okay. And Brian, from the landlord's perspective, I'm sure you're seeing a lot of the same just from the other side there, but why don't you tell us a little something about what they're saying?
Sure. Yeah. So the fundamental landlord concern, you know, even outside or before the COVID-19 pandemic, was really kind of preserving the sanctity of the cash flows from real estate. And so everybody learns in, you know, Real Estate 101 that the value of real estate assets are derived from the cash flows, you know, whether that's an investor pricing a deal or a lender making a loan. People are really looking at the revenues derived from the asset. And so that remains kind of the fundamental landlord concern, which is how do I make sure that I continue to get paid? Or perhaps now the more appropriate question is, how do I maximize what I'm receiving and minimize instances of loss? And so, you know, I think the duty of a good landlord's lawyer is to try to initially at least eradicate or, you know, at the very least minimize the instances in which tenants can, as Stacey noted, look at the document and by way of some provision, simply not pay rent. So, you know, at the very least, try to get folks to the table, but not create an instance in which a tenant can simply not pay rent or abate or offset rent. And so I think those traditional concerns still ring true today, perhaps to a greater extent now that this is becoming more of a systemic problem as opposed to something previously which was more isolated. And then aside from just, you know, protecting the rental stream, we're in a bit of a different spot now, I think, than we were back in March and April when clients were asking, as Stacey noted as well, more fundamental questions like, do I have to pay rent? Landlords were also asking, you know, should we keep our building open or close the doors? They were asking questions about local moratoriums on, you know, tenant evictions and in those processes. Another big question that we got early on is what, you know, is COVID itself a force majeure event or can it be treated like a casualty? I think to some extent as time has passed, you know, although these are still relevant questions, the markets are starting to normalize a bit around the answers to those questions. And as Stacey noted, we're now dealing with more salient issues, which are, you know, how best to negotiate some sort of amicable arrangement, whether that be, you know, rent deferral or outright abatement, to keep a tenant in occupancy and hopefully continue to receive rents down the road.
Okay. And I know on the tenant sides, many of the larger tenants, where there's a, you know, a global or national portfolio, they've created committees that might comprise of, you know, HR, facilities, finance, to address, you know, the work from home, the back to office, all those things around that. Are you seeing that with the landlords at all? Or are you dealing with the same, you know, the asset manager or the leasing agent? Has any of that dynamic changed, do you think, within the institutional landlords?
That's a question for me.
Yeah, Google. Sorry.
Yeah,
sorry,
yeah. I've not personally had a lot of insight into that aspect of it. I will say, just, you know, generally speaking, I think, as you're probably well aware of as well, leasing activity has slowed down. And I think all of those things are at the forefront of mind in terms of when offices reopen, what that will look like mechanically, how that will occur. You know, will there be restrictions on elevator use, for instance? I think those are all, from an operational and property management perspective, definitely at the forefront of mind. Mm-hmm.
Okay, staying with you, Brian, what new concepts are being introduced to leases and what common existing clauses are being modified or at least being maybe reevaluated right now?
Sure. So, you know, first off, I think landlords that are fortunate enough to have new leasing activity or even those that are involved in modifications are definitely trying where they can to clean up ambiguities in documents. So in terms of fixing provisions in a form or provisions that are in an existing lease that's being modified, I think they're taking hard looks at the force majeure and casualty condemnation and business interruption type provisions and trying to make absolutely clear that COVID-related issues and things that look like COVID, you know, other type of pandemic issues would not constitute force majeure. I think that was a big question early on, and gave rise to some unease, understandably, at the landlord level, where there were ambiguities in those sorts of provisions. So I think where possible, those are being cleaned up.
Yeah, so let's talk about that for a second. When you say being cleaned up, are you saying that landlords are open to readdressing those and maybe in future instances include pandemic as kind of force majeure, or is there another?
I think the force majeure provisions traditionally have been one of those boilerplate provisions and towards the end of the lease that folks look at to make sure that it's there, but didn't really ever pay a lot of attention to. I mean, mm-hmm. to some extent, mm-hmm. casualty and condemnation were treated the same way most owners of large office buildings, you know, in major urban areas aren't anticipating having the city condemn the building mm-hmm. or having a governmental organization condemn the building. And so I don't think they got necessarily the due attention that they deserved. And so in that vein, some force majeure provisions just speak broadly to, you know, acts outside of the control of the parties and things of that nature, and don't really get into the weeds on whether it is meant to delay a payment versus a performance obligation. So for instance, if I'm a landlord obligated to do a tenant build out in office space, that provision should I think rightfully extend the period of time in which I have to effect completion prior to the tenant getting some sort of remedy, whether that be rent abatement or the like. You know, I don't think the intent of force majeure provisions was to absolve payment obligations, generally speaking. And I think some of the ambiguity in provisions that aren't drafted quite as well as they may or probably should have been is what's giving folks heartburn. So when they're given the opportunity now to take a second look, to the extent, again, that those provisions aren't as sharp as they could be, I think parties are trying to make clear that those types of provisions are meant to address the delay in a performance obligation, not a payment obligation.
Stacey, are you seeing force majeure language being reevaluated right now as well from the tenant side?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's two points in force majeure that I've been seeing in leases and amendments at this point in time. And one of them is, as Brian said, to clarify and make sure that force majeure, that the pandemic falls within force majeure. I mean, some leases, there's usually a catch-all in the force majeure definition. And I've seen those in the past where they'll say not foreseeable by the parties. Well, if you're signing a new lease, now COVID-19 is foreseeable because it's currently happening. So I think I've seen a number of landlords adjusting their force majeure definition to specifically say pandemic, epidemic, moratoriums, et cetera. So I think there's the definitional point. But then I think there's an open discussion happening, or at least tenants are trying to make it happen, to talk about who should share and if there should be a sharing of that risk if there is another pandemic or if the pandemic is ongoing. And should that risk be split and accordingly reduce rent by some percentage? Should the lease flip to a percentage rent concept only if we have a force majeure, et cetera? So I think that most tenants are bringing that question to head now, whereas they would have just accepted the landlord's position previously, you know, as just typical boilerplate. We're at least talking about it now. I think we're yet to see how the market's going to change on that. And I think part of that's going to see how tenant friendly the market might become from the office space and vacancies.
And is that the sort of thing that can be addressed, you know, midway through a lease when there's nothing else going on, or is it the kind of thing where you need to address when you're evaluating an expansion or a renewal or a termination or something like that would affect the lease itself?
Yeah, I mean, from a tenant side, it's hard to adjust more boilerplate provisions in a lease unless you have some sort of negotiating leverage at that point in time. So as a tenant, you get your negotiating leverage when you're extending the lease, when you're negotiating a new lease, you know, when something is changing and you're offering something up.
Yeah.
So I would not expect a tenant to have success to just go to the landlord at this point and just ask for that change without doing something else at the same time.
Okay. Sticking with the new concepts in leases, are there any others from your guys' perspective that you've seen?
Yeah, you know, I've seen landlords asking for, I guess I'll call them preemptive waivers of the benefits of future legislation. So particularly when landlords are negotiating some sort of modification that involves rent deferral or rent abatement. And the thought behind these types of provisions is that the landlord is providing abatement or deferral today, kind of in liquidation, so to speak, of the risk of loss associated with the COVID-19 pandemic. And that for that present day payment, so to speak, that abatement, that deferral, the parties are waiving their rights to the benefits of future legislation. So, you know, by way of example, if a state subsequently passes a statute entitling commercial tenants to abate 50% of their rent until COVID subsides, you know, in that instance, the tenant would get a windfall, right? Because they would have benefited from the lease negotiation with the landlord, the deferral or abatement, and then also get subsequent relief via statute. And the landlord in turn would be doubly disadvantaged. And so, you know, these types of provisions wouldn't be meant to prohibit a tenant from receiving a subsidy for rent, similar to like a PPP payment, but would, as between the landlord and the tenant, settle future rights regarding rent abatement as between the two parties. And the clear issue with these types of provisions is that you can't always contract around laws. A state could always provide that some sort of rent relief statute is not waivable by contract, but nonetheless, landlords in some instances are trying to include these types of provisions and modification agreements that I've seen to, again, to liquidate the amount of the loss today, as opposed to leaving it unknown as between the parties.
Yeah, and from a tenant side, you know, the response is you don't know. It's difficult to waive something when you don't know what you're waiving. So we're talking about unknown future legislation. So the tenant really can't evaluate the pluses or minuses of agreeing to this rent deferral and giving up the unknown benefit in exchange. And I think Brian hit it on the head. We also just don't know whether or not these are going to be enforceable. One, if a court would enforce it, and two, if the legislatures will just legislate around it as well and say you can't contractually waive it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Totally new concept in the lease. So as tenants start thinking about getting back into their workforce, the number one thing is safety. Safety and wellness, first off. What sort of responsibilities do the landlords, you think, Brian, have to maintain a safe and clean property? And what is really on the tenant side? Who owns that within a building?
So I think it's today more of a two-pronged analysis. So I think you have, you know, the basic maintenance duties that are kind of delineated in the lease document regarding, you know, janitorial services and landlord's duty to maintain and clean common areas. And then I think there's also this I wouldn't call it necessarily a heightened standard, but more of a market standard. So, you know, I think prudent landlords not only are looking at, you know, CDC guidelines and trying to figure out any recommendations that might be made via those avenues, failing which, you know, it opens the door for a tenant claim that a landlord's being perhaps negligent in maintaining its property. And then also, you know, I would advise landlords to also kind of look across the street and keep up with the Joneses, so to speak. Because if a landlord is maintaining its property in a similar fashion as other similarly situated building owners in the submarket, I think it makes it much more difficult for a tenant to claim that a landlord was being negligent and acting unreasonably in the way that it sanitized or maintained the common areas in the building.
So you're talking about the language in the lease that will say you're going to upkeep your building essentially to the standards of if it's a Class A in the West Loop, which is always kind of a general, right? But is that kind of what you're referring to?
That as well. Yeah. I mean, you also don't want to be in an instance in which a tenant looks at the lease and says that the landlord is required to provide some threshold measure of service. And if that's tied to a market standard, and it, you know, they could find themselves making an argument that the failure to make that or provide those services gives rise to rent abatement. You know, you often see provisions that some sort of failure of service, which the landlord is otherwise required to perform, if not performed, gives the tenant the opportunity to abate rent. So going back to our initial point, trying to limit those possibilities in which landlord is not receiving rent, you know, this is another big issue for landlords.
Right. Not to kind of spend too much time on this, but I mean, this is like nothing we've ever experienced, right? I mean, this is, it's not just cleanliness. It's like, oh, you were supposed to spot clean the desk, you know, every other day and you didn't do it. That's ridiculous. You're not going to get, you know, any kind of rent abatement for that. But if a landlord is not providing kind of a clean area for the purposes of, you know, mitigating a pandemic, that seems like that's pretty major. That seems like that should be more responsibility, whether or not it's on the janitorial service or the building. But that seems like more of a safety issue to some degree.
Yeah, and I think you're right. And I think that's an issue of which landlords need to be mindful. I mean, it obviously don't want to open the door to claims by tenants or other third parties that are, you know, in the lobby of a building that they contracted COVID and that happened because a landlord was being negligent in cleaning or sanitizing. So in that regard, again, I would encourage a landlord to keep abreast of the CDC and other health organization guidelines. And also, again, kind of look across the street and see what other institutional players in the industry are doing and making sure that they're not behind the ball, you know, with regard to what other folks are doing.
Right. Okay. Stacy, next question is for you. There's been a lot of sublease space on the market nationally and more coming. There's talk of just a wave right after Labor Day. People have been using that as kind of marquee. But right now in Chicago, for example, there's 4.2 million square feet of lots of subleases mm-hmm. will be taken up, maybe not at the same pace as they did after the financial crash in 08. But what should tenants be concerned about when they're looking at taking on a sublease? Obviously, there's risks. It's a three-party transaction and the creditworthiness of the sub-landlord, but what else should they be thinking about?
Yeah, so if you're the tenant on a sublease, so you're going to become the subtenant, but as you said, you know, the first thing to think about is that your rights flow from the tenant and the master lease above you. So you first off need to be comfortable with what that master lease says, look at it, make sure that you can live with all the restrictions in it and decide and make sure that any rights that you want that are in that master lease are appropriately flowing through to you through the sublease. I'm thinking like parking, signage, those type of things are often missed when looking at a sublease. As you mentioned, you need to think about the strength of your sublandlord. If your master lease goes away because your sublandlord defaulted, they go into bankruptcy, you know, whatever, and you have an issue with your master lease, unless you got an agreement with the prime landlord, a non-disturbance agreement, then you're potentially out because their master lease is gone. So that's another risk that you have to consider. The other thing I would think about as a subtenant, you know, there's a number of things, but another one that often comes up is the consent of the prime landlord and the timing of that. And then what are going to be your, for example, your removal obligations at the end of the term? Are you taking on additional cost and risk when your sublease term ends and having to remove things that the sub landlord put in? So just a few things. I mean, ultimately, you need to get very comfortable with the master lease and all the provisions in it.
Yeah. Brian, anything you want to add to that?
Well, from the sub landlord's perspective, I mean, the issues are fairly similar to that of the landlord in that the sub landlord has a relatively fixed obligation to its landlord and can't be in a position in which the subtenant has the right to offset rent and thereby, you know, leaves the sub landlord in the lurch. I think, you know, subleasing was an imperfect solution in my mind for a tenant looking to exit space completely as opposed to finding a short term solution for reuse of space even before COVID. You know, most tenants in commercial office buildings aren't themselves in the business of leasing commercial office space. And so in terms of exiting a space, you know, subleasing the space for the remainder of the term, it's obviously less of a perfect solution than a wholesale assignment of the lease. And so putting these types of businesses in the shoes of a landlord, again, it's not ideal. I think that's kind of exacerbated in the era of COVID-19. I suspect that subleasing is more difficult for a number of reasons, predominantly because of the vacancy that you're seeing across the board in the office market. You've got other landlords competing with sub-landlords to lease space in buildings. And I think office landlords have, just by way of their position, more flexibility, right? They can offer longer terms. They can offer rental abatements, TI allowances, things that a sub-landlord who's beholden to their landlord may not be in a position to do. And, you know, there's a trend in commercial office leases that, you know, that I've seen whereby landlords provide that they can withhold consent to a proposed sublease if they've got similar space available in their building, right? Because they don't want to be competing with their own subtenants in chasing prospective tenants. And so in that regard, as office vacancy increases, you might find that it's even more difficult than it would have ordinarily been to sublease space, because landlords are now looking back to the provisions and saying, well, we're not going to consent to the sublease because we have similar space available and would prefer to lease that first.
Yeah, I always advise my clients to let me have a conversation with the landlord first to see what their thoughts are, so we can all be on the same page, so you don't waste everyone's time. You can waste a lot of time on a sublease. There's a million ways that deal can die. All right, we're going to wrap it up with your predictions in the office leasing market. Let's look at 6 months out, then 12 months out. Where do you think we're going to be, and how are things going to look? Let's start with you, Stacey.
Sure. So, I mean, I think the sublease trend is going to continue. So I think that market's going to continue to be very busy and very crowded. I think because of that, we're going to have challenges with underwriting new construction and probably financing of existing office buildings that are coming online. I know in Chicago, there were a number of buildings that were under construction and, you know, office space that was coming available in 2021. So I think that that market is going to be affected by the sublease market in the short term. So that's at least my 6 to 12 month thoughts. So we'll see.
Okay. Brian?
I'm gonna punt a little bit on this. I've never been in the business of predictions, whether it's elections or weather.
That was the next question. No, I'm kidding.
in all candor, I'm not really confident that anyone could give you a straight faced answer of what things will assuredly look like in 6, 12, or 18 months. I think if you ask people back in March, a lot of folks thought that people would be back to work by July. And then in July, it was September. And now we're on the cusp of September. And, there are businesses that have already come out and said that they're closed through the end of the year or even into 2021. And so, my answer would be I'm not at all certain where things are going to go in 6, 12, or 18 months. I think Stacey raises a good point. I would expect the subleasing market to continue to be active. I also think that fundamentally there will always be a need for commercial office space in downtown areas. I think it's too idealistic to say that the remote working environment is something that can just continue on indefinitely. I think at the end of the day, there's a social aspect to being in an office and being around your colleagues that will drive people back to offices. Now, will that be at 100% of occupancy that was pre-COVID? I candidly don't think so, but I don't know. And so it'll be interesting to see how things develop in the next 6, 12, 18 months as people are back to work in full force, so to speak, in the changing office landscape resulting from that.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I agree with that. And it'll be interesting to see how the pendulum swings as it relates to working from home, and as people are able to start going back to their office, how much the work from home stays in play and not. So we'll just have to see.
Yeah. The prediction question is something I've asked all my guests, and the intent is 6 months from now, I'm going to call you guys up and we're going to see how we all did. Brian, you punted that pretty well. Stacey, you put yourself out there. So
we'll see. Well,
but
again, that was my personal prediction. I clearly expect to be wrong because I was also one of the hopefuls that thought we'd all be back in June.
I hear you. It's a year like nothing else, day for day. But all right. Well, I really appreciate your time. I know it's valuable, and stay well and be productive.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks, Dougal. Much appreciated.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.